This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're with Joyce Kornblatt, all the way from Australia. So tell us what the book is about, Mother Tongue, the characters, and a little bit of the story.
Well, Mother Tongue, which is my fifth novel, is about, I can say this from the outset because it's on the first page, it's about a baby who is abducted as a newborn from a hospital in Pittsburgh and taken by her abductor, who was a nurse in that hospital, successfully escaping the police to Australia, where the mother lives incognito, you know, with an alias, for the rest of her life. And so the main character, Nella, grows up thinking herself a child raised in Australia by her birth mother, who had a sad life in America, doesn't like to talk about it, so gives herself reasons for the distance and the lack of information. And well, when her mother dies,
this is a fascinating book with a fascinating plot. So I want to start right off with you reading a bit of it, please. Mother Tongue.
The very first two pages from the first section, which is narrated by Nella. My name is Nella Pine, and this is my life story, as new to me as it will be to you who reads it here for the first time. I am the secret and the one who whispers the secret into your ear. I am the crime and the narrator's sleuth. I came upon the facts of my existence as one who returns to her home in the midst of a burglary. Here is the shattered glass, the rifle drawers, the thief with the booty still cradled in her guilty arms. When I was 3 days old, a nurse named Ruth Miller stole me from the obstetrics ward in Mercy Hospital and raised me as her own. This was May 7, 1968, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In Paris, 10,000 students rioted in the streets. Martin Luther King had been dead for a month, and Robert Kennedy's killer struck in June. The war in Vietnam was at its peak. In the midst of these larger convulsions, a smaller one, deadly as napalm, precise as an assassin's bullet, in the form of a nurse who kidnapped a child and vanished from sight. I was a healthy infant with a head of dark hair and an iodine stain shaped like a butterfly in the center of my brow. During the futile search for me and my abductor, that marking would become famous for a while. The butterfly baby featured on news reports and front pages and missing children's flyers in post offices and community centers and supermarkets all over America. By the time the authorities abandoned their hunt, the iodine stain had faded away, my most distinguishing characteristic no longer there to identify me. And as often happens to babies born with a full head of hair, that too was gone. I looked so little like the photo snapped of me in the hours following my birth that Ruth herself could begin to believe that I was a different infant entirely, not the one she'd taken from a mother in room 32B, who slept through the deed in sedated postpartum oblivion. At the end of her shift, Ruth lifted me from my crib in the newborn nursery, settled me into a sling she wore beneath her raincoat, and walked out undetected into the balmy Pittsburgh dusk. Smoke from the steel mill still turned the air rancid and yielded sunsets of exquisite and memorable radiance. If I had not been stolen away, if I had been able to witness again and again the evening sky of my birthplace, I would have learned early the lesson I'm struggling now to accept. Beauty resides in blight, and blight in beauty. Each holds the other like a seed in its hand.
Mm, What a writer. Joyce Kornblatt is the author of 5 novels, short stories, reviews, and essays. She's received the O. Henry Award, an Atlantic First Prize, a grant from NEA, a D.H. Lawrence Fellowship, and the Towson Literary Creative Fiction Award. And she was a professor at University of Maryland. You know, Joyce, when I read this, the story is about obsession, of course, but I have to say, under the line, there was a writer's obsession. What was your obsession that made you write this book that tears your heart out on the page?
Oh my, that's a very big question. It is there. And I would have to say it's early childhood loss in its many forms, both from the point of view of a child and from the point of view of a parent. And it's been a theme that's arisen in my life and my own family in various forms. So it's not one foreign to me, although, of course, the kidnapping is completely foreign to me.
Well, that's the power under the line, Joyce. I mean, that is the context for the wound, because this story did not come, and it is not a superficial story, and it is the intensity of the writing that got me so impressed and involved. Not only the story, which is a page turner, there's something that happens every page, but this throbbing pain beneath the line, it is really one of your most powerful works. How do you think it's different from your other novels?
I think it's different, Grace, in the sense that I finally, at this stage of my life, had the courage to fully enter this pain. And I would say this pain is not just of my personal life and generation, but it's intergenerational. It's the Holocaust, it's the whole Jewish history of loss and displacement that I could finally step fully into psychologically, spiritually, and really try to understand it as a great human challenge that people need to meet in many forms.
Yes,
in many contexts.
Loss is a hard thing to write about and to create stories and characters about, but loss is so large. How do we get our arms around it? How do we gather it in our arms except through humanity? Who are some of the characters in your story?
Well, there's Nella, the baby who grows up and finds out in her almost at 50 that she was abducted, and she has actually become a fiction writer, so she narrates a good portion of the book. We also come to know her as her birth name, Naomi. And then there is her husband. She's married for a time to Alex, and he comes in to narrate briefly his own story, to narrate it after he's died. So we have a voice of a dead person. And then there is her birth sister, Leah, who writes, begins her section on the eve of she and Nella and Naomi having finally contacted by phone after years of not knowing.
A lot of characters.
Exists.
If you take a string from one character to another, and every character has to have a storyline, one to the other, you can think of the complexities. What are the complexities here? Because I think there are questions that are being raised in this book that make it complex. What I know that you wrote it, so you may not have parsed it out this way, but what do you think are the complexities in your book? Besides loss and the human entanglements.
One that I had to sit with a lot, because it kept arising in the writing as organic, and yet I was afraid that it wouldn't feel that way to a reader, is the whole notion of coincidence, or what Jung called synchronicity. So there are so many characters in this book who have all in one way or another experienced significant, and in some cases catastrophic, soul-destroying loss. And I kept asking, can they all be in the same book and have come to know each other? And I thought, yes, they can and they must. That this is a more universal human experience than is often spoken about. It's often the tragedy that's denied, repressed, hidden, secreted. And I wanted this to be a book in which each character who spoke and the characters they spoke about would have a place to be able to be real and to be heard and to be genuine about their own heartbreak and their courage.
It's a lot to do. It is a lot to do. I'm sure you didn't think of all this when you started, or we never have gotten into it.
I did not have a plan for this book. I remember sitting in a cafe, and I hadn't written fiction for a while since my prior novel, The Reason for Wings, and the first couple of sentences came out on the page. My name is Nella Pine. This is my life story, as new to me as you. I was abducted at birth, and I was as shocked as I hope a reader is reading those lines. And then I began to see how metaphorically this could have arisen from this body and mind.
I want to get back into the novel, but do you think being a psychotherapist gives you an edge on knowing what makes us tick? Or not? Or isn't that, did that come to play into it? I mean, all the people you've worked with have to be in your database somewhere. And there has to be some sort of, in your DNA, an understanding of people that the average novelist does not have.
Well, that may be true, Grace. Psychotherapy was a second career after I moved here. After I retired from teaching at Maryland, I moved to Australia to be here with my Australian husband and his young daughter. I did retrain as a psychotherapist. And so, yes, I do think I have a certain kind of deep knowledge, but I'm not sure that fiction writers and poets don't have this in their untrained but deeply, deeply, deeply intuitive way. I'm not sure that wasn't my deeper training.
Well, we were talking about how you write a novel, and in this case, you're sitting in a cafe, and the novel comes to you. Is that different from what you experienced before? Is that the first time that's ever happened?
Yes, for it to come whole in the way that it did, and it came whole in other aspects as well, it was like receiving a dream. Whereas my other books came out of lived situations or research I'd done and kind of evolved gradually, the writing, discovering the writing. But this came whole without any sense of how I would achieve it on the page. That would reveal itself, the craft of it. And I didn't have a sense that it would be multiple voices. I couldn't imagine how I could write this book.
I really was going to ask you that. I was going to say, well, after you get up from the cafe, is it a character that gets a hold of you some kind of way? Or is it the story? Or do you have an idea? I mean, how did you take it from that blast to methodically develop the story? How did you do that? Was it with little white cards, little white index cards with plots on them?
No.
How did it shape itself? How did it shape itself?
It was an 18-year struggle. It was a novel, like 18 years. My other books I wrote in 2 to 4 years, 18 years coming and going from it. Many times setting it aside, thinking, I can't do this. Either the craft is too difficult or it's too painful, but it kept calling me back. I wouldn't say I returned to it. It came for me. And when I realized metaphorically that there was encoded in Nella's abduction, the depth of pain I felt as a as an almost four-year-old when my parents moved from the home of my grandparents, where I'd spent my first years while my father was away in the Navy during World War II. My parents then decided to move from that household in Boston to Pittsburgh, my father's hometown. And I never saw my grandparents again. They died within a year. And really, my grandfather had been my father, as I hadn't met my father until I was almost 3 years old. And that loss, I would come to discover later in life, was probably the most significant trauma of my entire life. And there have been others that followed, and it happened at a time, you know, when the inner world of children wasn't really acknowledged or understood. And so from my parents' point of view, they tried to shelter me even from the fact that he had died.
Mm-hmm.
And also they, from their point of view, I couldn't really be suffering.
Of course. Children have no interior lives. Children
no interior life. I was with my parents. They loved me. Mm-hmm. So there was no place for me to express, to process this great grief, which I came to see later as a client of a therapist myself, was responsible for a good deal of childhood depression and confusion. Where is my family? I would think sometimes, and then think I was going a bit crazy because I was with my family. So in that way, I felt like my subjective experience was one of a stolen child who didn't know from whom she was stolen or why she felt stolen. Then I could see this is my story.
If pain has beauty, if pain is transformed to beauty, there is the resurrection of this, all this. Well, we want to hear more. And so please carry us further and farther and deeper into this book. It's called Mother Tongue.
This is toward the end of Nella's section, and she's speaking here about her husband, Alex, an artist, a Sydney artist who she's married. And I'll just read you the first couple of pages from this chapter. Alex said his real name was meant to be Hector, the great Trojan hero. Hector Zavros, son of Daphne Zavros, and her secret red-haired Irish boyfriend, Patrick O'Farrell, who worked with her after school at a milk bar in Liverpool Street in Sydney. Once after their shift was finished, they got into his secondhand Holden and drove out to the park where Patrick knew of a hidden place beyond a stand of eucalypts and dense grevillea shrubs, where he met up with mates on a weekend night to drink beer and talk about girls and sex. This was a Wednesday night, September 1967. It wasn't the first time for Patrick, but it was for Daphne. When she realized she was pregnant, Patrick quit his job at the milk bar and told her he would ruin her reputation if she ever divulged his name as the father. "I'm a kid," he told her. "I can't go having a kid myself." Alex learned about Daphne from a daughter she had, Marina, his sister, who found him 25 years after Daphne had been forced to sign the adoption papers without even having a chance to hold her newborn son. "She didn't tell any of us about you until she got so sick right before she died. That's Lorena. A heart valve replacement that went wrong, a heart they hoped to fix, failing before she even got home from the hospital. I think it was heartbreak that did it," Lorena said. "No surgery can fix that, not after all those years of private grief." Daphne hadn't wanted to give up her child, not even when her parents sent her away to the home down the coast, 5 hours from Sydney, never coming to visit her, much like the other girls, 20 of them, children really, alone with the nuns who treated them more as delinquents, remanded to their care, and teenagers desperate for reassurance and mothering. Before she went to the home, Daphne had collected baby clothes in a cardboard box. She covered herself with flowered wrapping paper, three baby fleece rompers with feet in yellow, green, and white, little animal-printed t-shirts she found at a secondhand shop, a pair of crocheted booties, and a matching cap, no doubt made once by a doting grandmother, say, who couldn't wait to cuddle her grandchild once the baby arrived. She kept that box with her for the rest of her life, hidden away, and only told Lorena about it when she revealed how Hector, that's how she always thought of him, was taken from her in the hospital delivery room before she even had a chance to hold him. "It's best," the doctor said when she wailed for her son, and motioned to the nurses to hold Daphne down with a wooden board carved out in the center for her body. "So we don't hurt you. So we don't hurt you, miss." One nurse on either side of the restraint as another whisked Hector from her sight, never to be seen or heard again.
Joyce Kornblatt. For 25 years, she was at the University of Maryland in College Park and professor of English and creative writing. And now she lives in the Blue Mountains in Australia with her husband. And she has been a Buddhist meditation instructor and is a retired psychotherapist. She has five novels under her belt, as well as many other pieces of writing. She's an award-winning writer. I want to talk about tragedy because someone wouldn't think, well, you know, it's not really a classic tragedy. But I want your thoughts on this because I was talking to some people today about the book, and we were saying, you know, one philosopher says that tragedy is a conflict of ethics. Another philosopher says that it's the irrational mind against a rational mind. Now, those are two very broad things, but somehow they both fit your book. There's an irrational mind, there is a rational mind. There is an ethical question butting against another ethical question. I thought we had the best discussion today. I wish you were there. So is your book a tragedy? Or are Hegel and Nietzsche wrong?
I don't think they're wrong. I hope it's a redeemed tragedy in the broadest sense. It's obviously not a book in which terrible things turn out to be fantasies. Terrible things happen. There is a huge amount of suffering in this book. But there is a kind of redemption at the end because there is a reunion. Of making things right. And there's another way in which I think it is a redeemed book, and that is that the writer herself, Nella Pine, finds in the very act of writing the antidote to tragedy.
And don't we all?
And don't we all?
And that is the blessing. Art saves, if ever. There's a truer statement, art saves. But I can't get my head around 18 years where you could, what did you think? I mean, what, didn't you want something from the book that would urge you? What were you waiting to happen? 18 years.
I would write sections and think I was on the right track, and then I would read them and, you know, press delete if something wasn't working. It took me a long time to come up with the notion of multiple voices, especially one of the voices being someone who had died. I had to allow myself to take greater risks than perhaps I was used to as a fiction writer in the past, in a number of ways, some of which I won't speak about because...
No, but I must say, the risks in this book make the action in the book. Risk is action. And the risks that happen in the book that you take are what keeps moving the book. So that's really an important word you just used, I think.
Yes. And until I had the courage to take the risks myself that would allow the characters to take their risks, I couldn't really move the book forward in a way that felt that it had the kind of depth that I wanted.
Oh, that is such an important statement. I just hope every writer, I'm going to make that statement available to every writer, until you could take the risks. Your characters could not take the risks. Gosh, that is it. That's it. Yeah. You never teach another thing. Caraggio, right?
Yes, this is what I've learned as a teacher of writing for decades and as a writer myself, that you are not separate from your characters, even if they are fictional characters. They emerge from your psyche, from your soul, from your mind, and they ask of you what you are asking of them on the page.
Great. But, you know, there's also the fact that this is a story which happens all the time in the newspapers. So but I've never read a novel about it. So in another way, you have a gigantic wish and longing to tell a story. But then I think you've hit upon a kind of an unusual story that I do not think has been covered in fiction. So that must have come into play.
I don't think it has much. And so it did feel like very alien territory to me. I think I had read a newspaper account at some point during the writing, not before the writing.
Oh, yes, in the newspaper. But not
in the newspapers. Yeah. But no, never in fiction. You know, you might read novels about kidnappings, but not of infants, not of newborns.
So just as far as technique goes, do you go along with a narrative and then throw a monkey wrench in it and then go along with a narrative and throw another monkey wrench in it? I mean, is that how you get the twists and turns?
That if I do it, that's not conscious. Mm-hmm.
It happens.
It happens. I am aware that, you know, I'm writing and then something appears on the page, it feels like, not something that I put on the page, something, you know, is reflected back to me like, oh my goodness, now what? You know, so those twists and turns do happen, but I'd say they come from the unconscious, more from the conscious.
Well, we want to hear a final reading, please, of this fascinating book.
Thank you, Grace. Well, these are just the very first pages from the Leah section. Leah is Nella, known to her as Naomi's birth sister in Pittsburgh. They have just spoken on the phone for the first time. And they are preparing to actually meet each other in person. So Leah, all these years, never knowing the fate of her abducted sister until now. You called yesterday. You said, "Hello, Leah, this will be a shock." It wasn't. I'd spent my whole life waiting for you to come back, Naomi. I imagined you'd find me on a bus or at the library or in my classroom at school. You'd tap me on the shoulder 3 times, I dreamed. I would turn around to see you there. You would look serious and grave. "Hello, Leah," you would say. And on the phone you did. "Hello, Leah." Finally, I could rest. You called. As if I'd held my breath for 44 years, and now I could exhale. "Hello, Leah." What could feel more natural? One sister greeting another. It never occurred to me you wouldn't find us. Others said you were likely dead, or could never trace your way back to us. I knew they were wrong. How did I know this? How do you know the sun will rise again after it vanishes at night? There is an order in things. I trusted that. It was your absence that was the shock. Mom went to the hospital, birthed you, and came home shattered. I was 6 years old. "Where is our baby? Where is Naomi?" I asked. Dad said I couldn't keep asking. "It will make her very sick," he said. As if my questions were the cause of her suffering, as if silencing me could take her pain away, or his. He spoke for her, but as the years went on, I could see that taking care of Deborah was Dad's way of keeping the attention away from himself. He could pretend he was coping, while she was not doing well. A friend would phone, a neighbor would stop by, a relative would invite us over for Sunday brunch. His reply was always the same, "I'm sorry, but she's not doing well." In time, I learned all the words that explained how we suffered: post-traumatic stress disorder, codependency, complicated grief. And of course, your name, Naomi, which was also the word of our cure. Dad is dead. Mom has lost her memory. So I'm the only one left to receive the blessing of your return. It would be a miracle, our mother used to say, imagining how it would be if you came back to us, realizing she didn't believe you would. "She will come back," I'd answer, stroking her hair, wiping away her tears with my fingers. She would shake her head, as if to say she knew I was saying that to prop her up. But it wasn't like that at all. To me, it was a fact, as ordinary as the knowledge that the seasons would turn. Shall I read a little more, or is that?
I love that. No, that is such a satisfying reading. And you have such a voice. You must make a CD of this. I feel you just make me relax all over. And that was the voice. It is the voice of Joyce Cornblatt. Mother Tongue is the book. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipit Fund, by Natalie Canavore, and by Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.